Side 4, For Us the Living, by Robert A. Heinlein. Continuing on page 133. May it please the court? May it what? Oh, yes, surely. Go ahead. What is the alternative to taking treatment? The alternative is Coventry, by which I mean that you will be delivered to the gate of a reservation set aside for non-cooperative individuals, along with your credit turned into any chattels you choose. Or, if you prefer, you may emigrate to any country willing to receive you. What happens if I enter Coventry? You must enter the gate. What happens thereafter is no concern of the state. How long must I stay in the reservation? The judge shrugged his shoulders and did not reply. I'll take treatment. I was simply curious about the other. Very good. I see from the report that certain typical moral reactions may be expected from you, with a general classification of aristocratic. Do you recognize my authority?
Yes, Your Honor.
I am going to ask you to make me a promise. You need not, if you prefer not to. I want you to promise that you will refrain from doing any violence to any person whatsoever, including yourself, for any reason whatsoever, until you are pronounced cured, or until you come to me and tell me that you withdraw your word. Will you do it?
That's fair enough, I promise.
Good. I want to parole you to someone not in need of treatment himself. Who is your next friend?
Perry looked disconcerted.
Why, I don't believe I have any.
As he spoke, Diana stepped forward. The judge smiled.
Is she your next friend?
They both nodded.
Very well, then. You must understand that she is responsible to me that the instructions of this court are carried out.
He turned to Diana.
Take him to the State Correctional Hospital at Tahoe. The chief clerk will help you with the details.
That's all. Goodbye and good luck.
In the air car, Diana set the controls and turned to Perry with anxious concern in her eyes.
Well, darling, how do you feel?
Perry considered this.
I don't know. I was braced for a pretty unpleasant outcome, but I've been treated very decently. On the other hand, I have to go off someplace away from you and submit to treatment of indefinite duration and unknown sort. It's humiliating, and I don't feel happy about it. I don't like to be regarded as crazy because I know that I am not.
Diana patted his hand.
Nobody thinks you are crazy, darling. They think that you are suffering from bad emotional reactions through faulty training. Now they will attempt to retrain you so that you can be happy.
He grasped her fiercely. Do those fools think that they can train me out of loving you with a bunch of fancy phrases?
She kissed him tenderly before she answered.
Not at all, darling. You'll love me just as much or more, but you'll be happier in it, because you won't be all cluttered up with a bunch of false reflexes and wrong identifications.
You may be right, but I can't see it. I don't see how you can change human nature.
You'll understand that better in a few days. Relax and don't worry about it now. Come here and let me hold you.
She took him in her arms, cradling his lean young shoulders like a baby. She smoothed the wrinkles from his brow and closed his eyes. Presently, the little stubborn lines about his mouth ironed out, and he breathed more slowly. Diana suspected that he was sleeping and was still. The miles slipped by underneath. Then she roused him gently.
Perry, Perry, dearest, it's time to land.
I wasn't asleep.
No, but it is time to land. See below? That flat over there to the left? Put her down as close to the buildings as you can find room.
Righto.
Inside the administration wing, Diana gave Perry his instructions. Ask for Master Hedrick and tell them who you are. They'll tell you what to do. They were asked to wait for a few minutes. When Master Hedrick appeared, he turned out to be an unimpressive little man, rather thin, with scanty gray hair and a quick bird-like manner. He trotted up, hand outstretched.
Ah, there you are. We've been expecting you. Welcome to Shangri-La.
Shangri-La?
Just a poetical expression, an old man's fancy from a piece of classic literature I read when a boy. You've probably never heard of it.
I've read it. Perry spoke abruptly.
Oh, you have, really? Then you'll appreciate the allusion. Not quite as Elysian as the original, perhaps, but very beautiful, very beautiful.
Master Hedrick beamed as if he personally had weeded the gardens.
And we try to make the place have the same effect, the same effect. Hope to, hope to.
He cocked his head on one side and regarded them with chipper benignity.
But here, what are we waiting for? Visitors to Shangri-La must be fed first. Have you lunched? Then perhaps some tea or a liqueur?
No? A cigarette?
Perry took one from the proffered pack. It was already lighted when he withdrew it. He regarded it with some surprise. Hedrick beamed anew.
Clever, isn't it? Designed for me by one of our guests. Very clever man, but a little too preoccupied with mechanical devices.
Designed one intended to blow up the Earth. Didn't work, but he doesn't want to anymore. Designs integrating fabricators instead. Very ingenious, very ingenious. Never could understand them, but they work like a top, like a top. But come, you're not settled yet. Want to live in Bachelor Hall? No, of course not. We have some lovely apartments, or how about a cottage?
Perry didn't answer, but Diana diffidently suggested that they see the ladder.
Yes, indeed. Come along.
He led them at a quick trot downstairs and into a passage where a moving way delivered them to another stairway. They climbed the stair and found themselves in a pleasant, comfortable living room, complete in all necessary details except kitchen equipment. A fine view window faced out over Lake Tahoe. No other buildings were in sight. Hedrick indicated a path that led to the right along the shore.
The main buildings are a couple hundred meters down there, said he. You'll prefer to walk in fine weather. Now, I'll leave you for a while. Just make yourselves at home. We won't really get busy until tomorrow.
He trotted away. Perry glanced after him. Funny little guy. What is he, kind of a glorified janitor?
My heavens, no. He's the chief psychiatrist and director of the whole institution.
Perry whistled, then he changed the subject. How soon do you have to go?
Why, I don't have to go. I don't have a broadcast until Tuesday.
You mean they will let you stay here?
Surely, why not?
I'll have to be away a good deal because there is no place to rehearse here, nor to broadcast. They may want me to leave you a good bit of the time, but I'm certainly staying overnight and most nights, if I'm asked.
She lowered her lashes. He placed a finger under her chin, turned it up, and kissed her.
Of course you're asked.
The next morning, Hedrick appeared and asked if he might come in and talk for a while. The men settled down to becoming acquainted as Diana announced that she was going to run over and pick up Captain Kidd. The conversation rambled on for hour after hour. Perry found himself led into doing most of the talking, and doing so with great freedom. The little man was curiously disarming. His bird-like twitter and mild ways broke down the younger man's reticence. Gradually, he found himself talking about factual events alone. To it all, Hedrick offered a sympathetic attention, his head cocked on one side, his eyes bright and alert. When he arose to leave, Perry inquired somewhat nervously as to when the treatment would commence.
Hedrick beamed. It has commenced. Didn't you know it?
Then he departed, having promised to arrange as soon as possible for a competent economist to come in for a chat, which Perry had requested.
The talks continued, both with and without others present.
Hedrick turned over a part of Perry's case to Olga, a sturdy, blonde, earthy person who seemed out of place on the staff of a psychiatric institution. She had the hips and breasts for childbearing and the calm eyes of the natural mother. But Diana assured him that Olga had more than once collaborated with Diana's mother in complicated brain surgery. Olga directed Perry in a more comprehensive study of the modern world than he had undertaken with Diana's help. In addition to technical and non-fiction works, Olga selected for him many fictional and dramatic works, which she urged him to read or view. The two women got along together like old friends. Often Olga would appear with some book or record that she wished Perry to absorb, then the ladies would go for long walks in the surrounding hills. During Diana's numerous absences, Olga would frequently eat and spend the evening with him. Olga required Perry to do considerable writing, which he referred to facetiously as his homework or his examinations. There was an entire series in which he was asked to define terms. In the earlier papers, the words to be defined were comparatively simple, such as walking, road, apple, cat. Perry started in on these, blithely determined to show that he positively was not chasing butterflies. But these papers came back to him with discrepancies and confusing terms pointed out, and with a request for more nearly unmistakable definitions. He grew hot and sweaty, and struggled with attempts to say in words just exactly what he meant. Then his second attempts came back with a congratulatory note on the care with which he had made his definitions, but with a comment on his definition of horse. Does this definition include clothes horse, saw horse, horse play, horse dice? Please examine your other definitions with this comment in mind. Grimly,
He sat down to modify the definitions which he had believed to be so beautifully exact. He hit upon the following dodge, a phrase which he added to each definition, and many other meanings determined by the context, the speaker and listener, and the idiom of the period. Finally, he stated the proposition that a word is adequately defined when it is used in such a fashion that it means the same thing to the listener as it means to the speaker. He sent this in with the hope that it would settle the matter. He was soon undeceived, for he was requested the next day to define human nature, patriotism, justice, love, honor, duty, space, matter, religion, God, life, time, society, right, and wrong. After 3 days of fruitless struggle, in an attempt to do something with these words, he sent back the following statement. Insofar as I am able to tell, these words have no meaning whatsoever, for I am unable to devise any means of defining them so that they mean the same to the speaker as to the listener. The answer that came back was cryptic. Let the problem lie, but do not abandon it. Could you design a turbine without a knowledge of calculus and of entropy? He was then requested to formulate a mechanics of a pseudo-gravitation based on a law of attraction by inverse cubes instead of inverse squares. He became fascinated with the beautiful logical consequences of this problem and produced a monograph on the resulting ballistics. He was then asked if he could design sights for a gun to be fired under the postulated conditions. This request struck him as ridiculous, and he demanded an explanation of Olga. Olga, what is all this rigmarole? What possible use is it for me to design a worthless gun? Olga smiled a long, slow smile. I would like to tell you the meaning, but I can't. If you knew the meaning, the rigmarole would not be necessary. But you must discover meaning for yourself. We are trying to help you discover the meaning of the words you didn't define. I'd like to lay hands on the guy who thought up this last little joke. She took his hand and placed it on her shoulder. You did? Olga, I thought you were a pal of mine. I am, Perry, but it's part of my business to see that your treatment is approached through fields you understand and to watch its effect on you. However, I think we can skip a step at this point. You obviously don't want to bother with designing this gun sight, but you could design it, could you not? Certainly, nothing to it. You see, Perry launched into a flow of the technicalities used in ordnance and ballistics, and described with sweeps of his hands what would happen to a shell unlucky enough to be constrained by an inverse cube-type acceleration. And all this is in vacuo, of course. I wouldn't attempt to predict without empirical data the effect of a gaseous medium constrained by the same field. That's enough, Perry. I didn't understand a third of what you said, but I'm convinced that you could design the gun sight. Suppose we had such a gun and set it up here. Could you hit that sailboat over there across the lake? Of course not. Why not? Why, the mathematical formulas under which it was designed don't apply to the conditions under which the gun is fired. The more carefully you aimed, the more certain you would be of missing. Does that suggest anything to you, Perry? No, not offhand. You remember those words you didn't define? Weren't those words the names for things by which a man guides his life? Honor, love, truth, justice, duty, and so forth? A look of dawning comprehension came into his face. Yes, yes, I think so. Aren't these things just as powerful to move a man as the hunger of the belly or the stirring of the loins? Yes, yes indeed, more powerful. Then they aren't meaningless, but like that gun sight, unless the meaning you attribute to them bears a correct relationship to the world in which you act, you cannot possibly use them as guides to go where you wish to go. Yet without these guides, a man himself is as meaningless as a gun that can't be aimed. You make it sound very plausible, yet a man is not a shell in a gun, and truth and honor are not gun sights. No, they aren't. Let us drop the analogy before it leads us into absurdities. Nevertheless, I think you see that what I said is true, quite independently of the analogy. Men are moved to act by very complicated motivations tagged duty, love, sin, and so forth. You yourself are moved by them, and yet you are unable to define what you mean by these terms. You have accepted these concepts, more or less unconsciously, yet you know so little about them that you cannot possibly know whether they lead where you want to go or to disaster. If you attempted to pilot a plane, With as little knowledge of the controls, you would be sure to wreck it. You are here because you did such faulty piloting of your own life and smashed another person in the chin in the process. Granting that what you say is true, and I don't concede yet that I was wrong to hit that fellow, how do you discover proper meanings for these words that will enable me to conduct myself properly by them? How did you discover how to design gun sights that would enable you to hit the mark? Why, the theory of gravitation makes it a mathematical necessity. Are you sure? I seem to remember that the theory of gravitation was turned upside down and inside out in your lifetime. Did that cause all the gun sights to be junked? He slapped his thigh. By God, you're right. Exterior ballistics evolved by purely empirical means, trial and error. Whenever we got enough data to analyze, we invented formulas to fit. We never tried to make the practice fit the theory. When the theory didn't fit, we junked it and made up a new one. But it worked. We built machines in that way that were marvels of accurate prediction, he said, and thought. Then his face clouded. But how can you apply that technique to the problems of living? Well, Perry, so far as I know, there are just two ways of working out a practical theory of human relations that will enable us all to live happily together. One is the hard way of trying to work out empirical principles from what we know of the real world. The other is by divine revelation. I won't say that the second way is impossible, but we moderns have grown to distrust it. Our conclusions in 2086 from the first method are embodied in the current code of customs. He who complies with that code will live with reasonably little conflict in 2086, whether he believes that the code is a list of final truths or simply rough generalizations. The code embodies our 2086 meanings for these troublesome words that you could not define. You have other meanings, unspoken, and in my opinion, your meanings are both inaccurate and dangerous, for I believe that if you were able to define your code in spoken objective words, you would find that your code did not correspond to the real world around you. But that still doesn't tell me how you arrive at these customs or empirical formulas for conduct or whatever you care to call them. Much as you perfected the art of ballistics, by a willingness to junk theories that didn't fit the facts. For example, the churches, by and large, set their faces against divorce. Divorce was a sin. No attempt was made to study marriage and divorce objectively. Divorce was sinned by divine revelation, and that settled it. It is almost inconceivable the amount of harm that was done by that one false generalization alone. By rejecting the dogmatic viewpoint and examining the problem in its environment, we reached quite different conclusions. In the 2086 environment, divorce is not a sin, although it is possible to conceive different social patterns in which divorce would be sin. Consider again the subject of clothing as a taboo. Again, a dogmatic generalization for social conduct decreed that it was wrong, dishonorable, immodest to appear unclothed. Original sin was involved. Complicated aesthetic ideas were given a false objective reality, and so forth. An amazing mass of philosophical nonsense was written on this one taboo alone by people who would never think of taking off their clothes in the presence of others in order to see what it felt like. Their faces were resolutely set against such irreverent experiment, even as the scholasticists of the Middle Ages refused to watch any experiment which threw doubt on the perfection of Aristotle's mechanics. And yet the experiment was always available and easy to perform. In 2086, from purely experimental considerations, the clothes taboo is destroyed. It does not appear in our code of customs, and one may dress or not as convenience and personal aesthetic taste indicates. Again, take politics. For centuries, philosophers attempted to formulate the perfect state, reasoning from their own unexamined prejudices, which they usually assumed to be divine revelation. In 2086, we consider that the perfect state is a meaningless sound, having no objective reality. Instead, we set up a political system to achieve whatever we wish to accomplish in 2086. We have no notion that it would have suited 1000 AD, nor that it would suit contemporary Europe, nor that we will leave it unchanged in the future. But we do believe that we have evolved a technique by which we can make the state serve our purposes in any age. She glanced at the chronometer. I have other things that I must do now, and I believe that you should think over and develop for yourself any new ideas from this talk. Bye-bye. 8. These exercises in realistic thinking continued in various ways. Perry found himself unable to distinguish between activities which were a part of his treatment events simply intended to entertain and thereby keep him happy in his environment, and activities which he had selected for his own edification or fulfillment. Early in his stay, he had expressed a desire to continue with his study of modern mathematics. He was given every facility to do so, but in time lost interest in the face of other activities, and especially his rapidly growing friendship with Olga. He was surprised to receive a call from Hedrick, who urged him to pursue his mathematical studies to the limit, and, if possible, to develop some new aspect of the art. Perry inquired if this were standard psychiatric procedure. Hedrick hastened to reassure him. "Not at all, not at all. But if a person under treatment has a mathematical predisposition, the development of that bent may be used very handily to clear up his particular difficulty. Yours is a case in point. You think very admirably in the field of physics, in which your terms are almost entirely mathematical. You are able to make useful predictions, and are able to avoid fallacious identification of terms. You are able to appreciate and even invent little mathematical jokes based on a deliberate confusion of terms. You can prove to me that 1 + 1 = 1, or air cars won't fly, for our mutual amusement. This does you no harm because you have deliberately confused certain terms and used them with different meanings in the same problem in order to achieve a willfully ludicrous result. When your thinking in social relationships reaches the same order of development, you will no longer be tortured by the emotional upsets that impelled you to consult us." "Is that all that insanity amounts to, a confusion of terms?" "Oh, my, no. Even in your own case, confusion in terms is not the only problem. You not only confuse the various meanings of some terms, but you also fail in certain respects to perceive the pattern of your structural relationship to your environment. This produces trouble which may be likened to that experienced by a thirsty traveler who believes that a heat mirage is a lake. Your trouble is not of that simple order of perception of physical phenomena, but in a much higher order of abstraction. Yet it is as difficult for me to explain to you the exact nature of your trouble as it would be for you to explain a mirage to an ignorant savage. Your only hope of getting the savage to understand a mirage, in the fashion in which you understand it, would lie in giving him a long course of basic instruction in modern science, having first, and this is very important, untaught him 1,000 superstitions and false identifications with which his mind is crowded. You are now in the process of unlearning your errors and superstitions. At the same time, you are beginning to teach yourself a more satisfactory concept of the cosmos. But I haven't answered your question. You are not insane, any more than our savage. You are simply confused as the savage was. In each case, the confusion can be eliminated by proper training. Yours might well have taken place in a children's development center, had you been of the proper age. Moreover, because of the maturity and exceptional ability of your mind, we can enable you to retrain yourself in a fraction of the time necessary to train a child. With respect to other methods of treatment, naturally, if a person is truly insane, suffering from physical lesions, whether congenital, traumatic, or pathological, we treat by physical means, surgery, chemical therapy, physical therapy, and so forth. Frequently, there is little we can do other than care for them, keep them from harming themselves or others, and prevent them from reproducing. But in any case in which the brain and nervous structure are not injured, we have not yet failed to achieve a satisfactory retraining into a state of full sanity. Yours is not even a difficult case, my boy. I feel sure that both of us will be satisfied with the result." Perry stirred uneasily in his seat. "What you say may be true, and I would hesitate to contradict you in your own field. Certainly, I have acquired a lot of new ideas and new concepts and new ways of thinking about things in the past weeks. Nevertheless, I don't feel any different about the thing that landed me in this mess. I'm still in love with Diana, and I'm jealous as hell of her. I enjoyed taking a poke at that guy, Bernard, and would enjoy doing it again. I don't want any man to lay a finger on her. In spite of my inability to define human nature, I think you know what I mean by the term, and I think it's in human nature that I should feel as I do, and I don't see how you can change human nature, mine or anybody else's." Hedrick smiled and put the tips of his fingers together carefully, cocked his head on one side, and replied, "You are right, my dear boy, entirely right, except about the immutability of human nature, in which you are partially wrong. I am quite prepared to believe that you are physically jealous of your woman in an acutely emotional manner. It is true that this emotion results from your own human nature, and that it is potentially present in all males and also in females, although it arises in females from a different source of more recent origin and less deep-seated in character. The jealousy of the male for the female may be observed in animal life, in the battling of tomcats, the duels to death of stag deer, and the fighting cockbird. It is present in all animals, human and otherwise, and is both a necessary consequence and a determining cause of the survival of all bisexual life. It is very simple. The male who was unwilling to fight other males for the privilege of sexual intercourse did not reproduce. His line died out. Each generation, by and large, was descended from males who would fight for the females. Any factor in human nature which is necessary or helpful to the continuance and propagation of life may be termed a survival factor, and each generation will exhibit by necessity these factors: sexual urge, belly hunger, group loyalty, heliotropism, whatever they may be. You may term, if you wish, the resulting complicated manifold of instincts, desires, reflexes, emotions, and so forth, human nature, animal nature, or the nature of life. But you must remember that these are complex terms implying many factors and arising from myriad environmental circumstances in the history of the race. And you must remember that environments change. Now, a factor in human nature remains a survival factor only as long as the environment continues to make it so. For example, on a dairy farm, sexual jealousy is no longer a survival factor for bulls. On the contrary, a bull is not allowed to fight. His major survival factor is his ability to breed daughters who are big milk producers. It is useless to argue that he is in an artificial environment. The distinction is a specious one. A man-made environment is as natural as that of the jungle, unless you insist on a purely verbal distinction that divorces man from the rest of nature. Perry, you now find yourself in an environment in which the factor of physical sexual jealousy is no longer a survival factor. On the contrary, it decreases your chances to survive. Yet the factor still exists in your nature. You say that is that and that nothing can be done about it, which would be true if you were a bull. But you are not a bull, and there is an essential difference between modern man and other animals. Men are able consciously to examine their motives, emotions, and so forth, and by a conscious process to inhibit or divert a reaction, reflex, and so forth. He can control his emotions or modify them by conscious application and thereby change human nature. You think not? Let us consider the case of another survival factor, the fear of falling from a height. You ride in air cars. Are you afraid of the height? Does it cause you any nervousness? Does it upset your digestion, prevent you from sleeping nights, cause you to wake screaming from nightmares? Today, the fear of heights is potentially present in that inherited matrix you call human nature. It's nearly as old as the sex urge. Say, put in Perry, you're right. I've had such dreams lately as a result of a fall, but I'm not bothered anymore, not in the least. Let's take another case, belly hunger. It is the oldest factor of all, reaching back past the origin of bisexual life. If human nature is not subject to change, it should be the strongest of all and uncontrollable. Do you drool and slobber at a display of food? Do you fall on it like a wild animal? Do you snatch it from the plate of another? Do you sit up nights worrying about it? Yet it is there and basic. A change in environment would develop it to the point where men would fight for it, claw crusts of bread from dustbins, steal, rob, kill. You can supply many examples from experience and history. Do you begin to see that the active exercise of the factor of sex jealousy is today as stupid, as silly, as uncouth, and as unnecessary as the feeding habits of the jungle? Perry nodded soberly. I begin to see, rationally at least. I'm afraid my emotions won't change quite so readily. Don't let that worry you. Proper emotional habits may be acquired like other habits, by conscious exercise over a period of time. If you control your acts along the pattern you desire and exercise your will, your emotions will change. That may seem unlikely, but I assure that it is a report of observed fact. Analogy in the cases of other primitive urges may make it credible to you. Before we go further, I would like to point out to you that the factor of sex jealousy, as present in you and as exercised in the environment in which you matured, was not always present in the same way in all times, places, and culture. Polygamy is, of course, well known to you, if not through experience, at least by report. It is a matter of reported fact that women in polygamous cultures were not made unhappy by the practice. The early Mormon culture is a case in point. Polyandry is less well known, but was common in Tibet for a long period and worked very satisfactorily. In certain parts of Asia in recent times, it was a common practice for a host to loan his wife or daughter to a guest for the night. It would have been bad form to refuse. Among certain of the Eskimo tribes, it was the accepted practice in very recent times
to exchange wives for considerable periods, usually for reasons of domestic economy. To have disputed the practice or stirred up a fuss about it would have been thought barbaric, not to say immoral. Among certain of the Polynesian tribes, promiscuity before marriage was the accepted rule. On the other hand, among the Zulus, as late as the 20th century, a maid ready for marriage was examined by a committee of elder women. If they did not pronounce her a Virgo intacta, she was beheaded. In contrast to this, among many people, prostitution was a religious rite, reaching the extreme point in at least one highly developed culture wherein a woman could not marry until she had passed at least one night as a public prostitute. The illustrations from anthropology are endless. I have cited enough to show you that the manifestations of male sex jealousy occurring in the culture in which you were reared are not the result of an inflexible law. The case of female sex jealousy of the male differs greatly from that of the male. Female sex jealousy is primarily economic in origin. That of the male is primarily biological. The desire for sexual intercourse is not an important survival factor in the female. She may be impregnated without it, or even in the face of a strong contra-desire, as in rape. The dominant survival factor for the female is the need for protection and support during gestation and while caring for infant children. This will take the form of possessive sexual jealousy in any environment which requires her to capture the full attention of one man to achieve the end. It is not necessary that she be consciously aware of this. It is automatic. By and large, in such an environment, only the females who function in that pattern are able to reproduce. Many environments do not lay this requirement on the female. Yours did to a marked degree, if the literature and records of your period are correct. From all I can gather, the competition among women for the exclusive attention of one man must have been as fierce and ruthless as any jungle battle. It appears from history that the women of your period and before were able to freeze into law and creed that a man must take one woman and support her and her children to the exclusion of any other interest. A woman who connived with a man to break this stringent code of battle, as in adultery, was destroyed by her sisters as completely as they were able. Nevertheless, even in your day, the signs of environmental change and consequent changes in your immutable human nature were in evidence so far as women were concerned. They were gaining greater economic freedom and consequent greater sexual independence. They no longer needed to the same extent the economic support of husbands. It was even possible for a woman of foresight and ability to bear and rear children without the economic support of a male. With increased knowledge and use of practical, convenient methods of controlling conception, women were liberated somewhat from the pressing necessity for capturing a man and holding him. With the advent of the new economic regime, women no longer required the services of a man to support herself or her offspring. For the first time in history, women reached the dignity of social equality with men. Up to that time, any equality with men granted to them was spurious, a mere verbalism, having no real foundation in fact. The social consequences were of enormous importance both to women and to men. For the first time in history, men and women could mate as equals without fear of concealed motives. Life was enormously enriched thereby. Love between the sexes could develop aesthetically in a way never before possible. Freed of the twin vices of masked rape and masked prostitution, it developed a beauty, a variety, and a richness limited only by the imagination and sensitivity of the individuals concerned. Not only did it glorify the love between man and woman, but it made possible a deeper, less antagonistic relation between man and his brother, woman and her sister, for the primary causes of rivalry were gone, gone for men as well as for women. Why? You recall that the primary cause of sex jealousy in men was the desire for intercourse. In former cultures, other men might lure away a desired woman with economic bait or capture her bodily. Now that the woman is no longer subject to coercion but is a free agent, the competition between males for a woman's charms is necessarily by gentler means. Excesses of jealousy are likely to defeat their own ends and lose a woman completely. You are lucky that your chosen woman was sufficiently primitive in her emotion and loyal in her intellect that she decided to stick by you. Many women would have told you to go to the devil and taken up with a less selfish man. Perry was startled to hear himself called selfish. He started to speak, then thought better of it, and held his tongue, his face a study in mixed emotions. Hedrick continued. As a matter of practice, a man usually finds that he has lost nothing at all by ceasing to respond to the emotion of jealousy. Strictly from a biological point of view, there is much data to prove that
potential capacity for sexual indulgence is much greater in most women than it is in most men. So much so that an average woman could be the mistress of, let us say, two or three average men without loss to the men. On the spiritual side, there is enough of the mother of all living principle in the nature of any woman to permit her, if she chooses, to be the source of spiritual refreshment to many men. Any man who believes the contrary is a fool who judges the soul of woman by the paucity of his own. He need only look at the mother of any large brood to know that the capacity of a woman to replenish the soul with her love is limited only by the scope of her field. I speak now of the ordinary run of men and women. In some cases, a man may be a sufficient companion in every way for more than one woman, in which case the situation is reversed, but is otherwise similar. Do you mean to say that such combinations as you have described are the usual order today? Not at all, not at all. We Americans in 2086 remain, by and large, monogamous. If for no other reasons, the approximate 50-50 balance of the sexes, habit and convenience would make it so. In addition to that, it takes time for a rich love to mature, and one does not lightly throw away such a possession. You think that you are in love with Diana today, my boy, but if you are still with her 10 years from now, you will wonder why you graced so thin and feeble an emotion with that name. No, we pair off and stay paired on the average, but that does not preclude the formation of other associations, either more temporary or less deep, or both. No one partner in life can supply all the possible richnesses of living to another. I speak now not only of physical sexual associations, but also of associations mental and spiritual, such as I observe that you are forming, you'll pardon me saying so, with our good friend Olga. Perry blushed to his hair roots. No, no, son. No cause for embarrassment. I invaded your private sphere because I am your physician and have occasion to. Olga is a fine woman, finer than you now imagine. Your association with her is bound to do you good in every way. I am happy to see it. Master Hedrick yawned and glanced at the chronometer. If I don't turn in fairly soon, I shall need a stimulant in the morning to attend properly to my duties. I've just one more thing to say. I want you to make a list of the things you expected to protect or obtain by driving this other young buck away from Diana. Be as explicit as possible, and mind how you use your terms. Take as long as necessary, and let me see the result. By the way, when do you expect her back? Tomorrow, probably. She just ran up to Chicago for a special broadcast. That's good. There's a rather interesting job over in surgery tomorrow that she would like to see. Diana's mother is coming here to perform a Dexter cerebrectomy. You might drop in, too, if such things interest you. Accident case. Very sad. Young rocket pilot. Thank you, sir. I think I will if Diana is back. Hedrick arose and knocked out his pipe. Just a minute, sir. Doesn't anyone maintain a lifetime monogamy anymore? Hedrick desisted from tickling Captain Kidd's belly and considered this. Very possibly. There are a lot of possibilities in 190 million people. Seems unlikely, though. You might try your hand at working out the equation of probability involved, if it amuses you. I think you'll find enough data on file over in the archives to give it a try. Well, good night. Good night, sir. 9. I would have come to see you sooner, but the problem presented unusual features that required study. The speaker was a little stoop-shouldered man with a bulging, bald head. He addressed Perry over a glass of sherry in the latter's cottage. When Master Hedrick told me that he wanted me to explain the theory and practice of our present economic system to a man with the point of view of America 1939, I thought that he was in need of some of his own treatment. But when he elucidated, I realized that I was confronted with the most startling problem in pedagogy I had ever undertaken. I wasn't able to undertake it without preparation. I had to search out and read much of the literature of your period, and then spend several days in meditation in order to try to feel the period, understand the point of view, evaluations, and the fallacies of your time. Perry shifted uneasily in his chair. I didn't intend to cause you so much trouble, Master Davis. No trouble at all. You have done me a service. This is a most fascinating approach to the subject that has been my principal interest. By preparing to explain it to you, I understand it better myself. First, tell me what you know of the present system. Well, in the first place, it has retained private enterprise in industry. There, I suppose, it's a form of capitalism. Davis nodded. An inadequate word, but let it stand. Perry continued. However, although production and so forth is private enterprise, each citizen receives a check for money, or what amounts to the same thing, a credit to each account each month from the government. He gets this free. The money so received is enough to provide the necessities of life for an adult, or to provide everything that a child needs for its care and development. Everybody gets these checks, man, woman, and child. Nevertheless, practically everyone works pretty regularly, and most people have incomes from three or four times to a dozen or more times the income they receive from the government. There is no such thing as unemployment, because there is always a demand for more production. Consequently, wages are high. However, prices are low. And to make the situation even more confusing, merchants regularly sell goods at less than cost, and the government pays them the difference. That is the general setup, if I understand what I have been told. It sounds impossible, an Alice in Wonderland business, filled with contradictions that deny common sense. It disturbs me. It challenges my reason. I'd be less annoyed at a perpetual motion machine. Davis smiled. I appreciate your difficulty. It is necessary first to clean your mind of a number of the errors, superstitions, and half-truths that went by the name of economics in your day. Consider for a moment the physical facts of the situation that you see around you. Disregard the money aspect for a moment and think in terms of goods, people, production, and consumption. What, then, is the situation? Well, I see that everyone has a pretty high standard of living. They live in good houses and eat plenty of good food, and they have plenty of the comforts of life. That's the consumption side. On the production side, I see factories and farms and so forth that produce at a high rate with lots of labor-saving machinery. Nobody has to work very hard unless he really wants to. Anybody that does gets a big return for it in terms of goods and services. Do you see any difficulty in the picture now, still leaving money out of it? Well, no. The physical wealth is there, and the work done is enough to turn it into a high standard of living. Now describe 1939 in terms of physical economy, again leaving out money. Be careful not to use any term that implies money, such as wages, debt, price, and so forth. Perry grinned. You're preparing a trap for me. I can see it coming. Davis was serious. It's not a trap. It's a necessary expedient to lead your mind around its ingrown economic errors and enable it to think correctly. Go ahead and describe it. Okay. The country was just as rich in natural resources, richer as a matter of fact. We had plenty of factories to fabricate raw materials, but lots of them were shut down. Our farms produced liberally plenty of good food, enough to feed everybody well. We had the technical knowledge, tools, and materials to produce an abundance of luxuries and comforts, and in fact we did, for our retail stores were stocked to the ceilings with every sort of desirable article. That is the production side. On the consumption side, about half of the population had less to eat than it needed, and that of poor quality and wrong variety. In other respects, they were worse off, living in houses that were fire traps and disease breeders, frequently without running water and with primitive heating systems. Most of them had no medical or dental attention and were rotten with disease. My dentist once told me that 4/5 of the population never received dental care in their lives. The next third or so of the population just barely got by. They lived in fair comfort, but in the fear of slipping back into squalor. A small group at the top had more than they needed of everything. While I'm speaking of consumption, I suppose I should mention that we made a practice of destroying annually a large part of our production, especially food. Some people considered this wasteful, and we devised means to produce less rather than destroy part of what we had produced, but it came to the same thing. You speak of a small group that had too much. Do you know what the result would have been if everybody had consumed share and share alike? As a matter of fact, I do. I used to worry about that and worked it out on my slide rule in 1938 from some figures quoted in Time magazine. That was a news sheet published in those days. The average national income came to about $130 per month per family, which wouldn't have been a very high standard of living. But the same figures showed that only 30% of the population had that much or more. 70% had less. I have to mention money at this point, but I'll translate it into goods. A family at that standard of living would live in a cheap house, drive a second-hand car, set a decent but not fancy table, have a radio, and go to the movies occasionally. But they would have no reserves, and sickness, accident, or the loss of a job would land them almost overnight in squalor. Then, still speaking in physical terms, was this average standard of living the best the country was capable of, by and large? Oh, no, not nearly. The country was able to produce at least twice as much as was actually produced. Some authorities said 3 times or more.
but anyone could see by looking around him that much more could have been produced. For one thing, at least 10 million people were out of work. Very well, then. You have described two different economic systems in terms of the physical realities involved. Now, which one of them denies common sense? Which one challenges your reason? Perry smiled. You've sprung your trap, just as I anticipated. The 1939 system is the ridiculous one, certainly, when you look at it that way. But that still doesn't explain your cockeyed financial arrangements. The paradoxes you appeared to find arise from flaws in your training. They have no reality. I am about to state an axiom. Anything which is physically possible can be made financially possible if the people of a state desire it. That sounds good, but is it true? Yes, if the people of the state understand finance. Tell me, what is money? Money. Money is a lot of things. It is a medium of exchange based on some precious metal, usually gold. It is also a commodity bought and sold and rented out for interest, and it's capital for industry. Which one of those things is it? Well, when you come right down to it, I guess money is gold. That's what J.P. Morgan thought. At least he told a Senate committee that in 1912. I wonder whether he was lying or deluded. Try this definition. Money is anything which can always be swapped for goods or services. I believe that you will find that to be the only characteristic common to all money and common to nothing else. How much money does a country need? How can anybody answer that question? Apparently nobody tried to before the present economic regime. Money was expanded and contracted in a most senseless fashion. The Panic of 1907, for example, was produced by a deliberate contraction of money. But the answer to the question is simple and arises from the nature or purpose of money as we defined it. A country needs enough money to enable its citizens to perform all desired exchanges of goods and services. Your 1939 system did not accomplish this. Our 2086 system does. But look, there was plenty of money in 1939. That doesn't make sense. Haven't you just told me that in 1939 there were millions of people who needed things they couldn't buy? And weren't there merchants who had all these things and wanted to sell them very badly yet couldn't sell them? Wouldn't all this have been very different and vastly improved if the people in dire want had had that money in their pockets to buy from the merchants who had to sell or go bankrupt? Isn't that a shortage of money? Yes, of course, but where are you leading me? Patience, in 2086 the government gives money to the people to do that necessary buying. Yes, I know. Master Cathcart told me that the government got this money off the printing press or out of the inkwell, in other words, fiat money. How can it be worth anything? We decided that money was anything which always could be swapped for goods and services. That implies that the person who accepts it believes that he can do likewise. Therefore, money is money as long as everybody believes it is money. There is a touchstone which will enable you to determine whether or not people will believe in money. Can you use it to pay taxes? Will the government give you something for it of value, postal service, for example? If the people collectively as a state will accept it, then so will the individuals. Our fiat money qualifies. The United States will accept it in exchange for things of value. That is no longer true of your gold. It can't be used for taxes. You may or may not be able to swap it off. It isn't money, and you may be stuck with it. As a matter of fact, all United States currency has been fiat currency ever since the United States suspended gold payments in 1933. Since that time, the gold standard has been simply a fiction convenient in party politics. However, I believe that your principal difficulty is in understanding why it is necessary for the government to create new money and give it away to the consuming public. In order to understand that, it is first necessary to understand the mathematics of the relationship between prices and purchasing power. Before we go into the mathematical theory, let me state the fact which we are to explain. In 1939 and before, the sum total of the purchasing power of the public was always less than the total price of the goods offered for sale. This is just another way of saying that overproduction, with its attendant unemployment, poverty, labor warfare, and so forth, was a chronic condition. As a matter of fact, it is not necessary to understand the mathematics behind it, as long as you observe the fact, just as it isn't necessary to know how a house caught fire in order to see that a house is on fire and to realize that something must be done about it. I stated that overproduction was chronic, and that it is identically the same thing as saying that the public as a whole didn't have the money with which to buy the goods offered for sale. You will certainly agree that such was the condition from 1929 to 1939. It was generally recognized,
and the government even went so far as to partially make up the spread between prices and income by direct relief, giving money away, and wages for made work, giving money away with a moralistic sugar coating. This would have been sensible had the government created the money by fiat. Instead, they borrowed it from the banks, who created it by fiat. This was silly, as it piled up a national debt to be reckoned with in the future, and the money wasn't one whit sounder under the fiat of the banks than it would have been by government fiat. For please understand that the money lent the government by the banks to provide relief did not come into existence until it was borrowed. The bankers took it out of an empty vault. They fished it out of the inkwell. This may be hard to believe, but it is the literal truth. Every time a bank loaned money in those days, it created it. Of course, President Holmes would successfully reclaim this practice for the government decades later, but at this time it was entirely imprudent. But to return to overproduction. Before 1929, in the period after the World War until the market crash, the spread between production and consumption was absorbed in several ways. An enormous increase in private credit or debt, especially in the development of installment buying, exploitation of foreign fields, particularly in Central and South America, which means to give away goods and get engraved paper in return, which later turns out to be worthless, and in losses suffered by practically all farmers and many businessmen. You see, a large percentage of businesses failed even in boom times, in which case their inventories were sold below cost. The condition in the World War years is simple to understand. During war, production goes at maximum speed for the war machine and burns up the excess. Of course, an enormous load of debt is created, which must someday be canceled in some fashion. Before the World War, there were many years in which the pattern was similar either to the boom 20s or to the depression 30s. In either case, production always ran ahead of consumption and was disposed of in the usual ways, by the creation of debt, by destruction of price values through bankruptcy, by sending more goods out of the country than were taken in, or by outright destruction of goods as in war, or as was done in peacetime, by crop destruction. The case in which more goods are shipped out each year than are imported deserves special mention. For many years, this was regarded as the ideal economic condition, although any child can see the absurdity of it, but it was called by all sorts of fancy names: favorable gold balance, favorable trade balance, the American plan, cornerstone of American prosperity. It was taught in the public schools as a natural law. Yes, mused Perry, I remember being taught that in grammar school. My geography book devoted a whole section to telling how necessary it was. As a matter of fact, it was as vicious as it was silly. Each nation tried to sell more than it bought, and this was the basic cause of every war in modern times. The stupidity of the idea should have been obvious, but the nature of the financing system made it inevitable. Since production always exceeded consumption by a wide margin throughout this period, it was necessary for a nation to get rid of its excess as best it could, or suffer severe economic upset at home. Many were the devices to promote this, for example, the protective tariff and the subsidizing of the merchant marine. Note: the reader need not accept this without proof. Fortunately, the records of the period are available in the Washington Archives. See Statistics of the Department of Commerce et al. For those years. The author. End of note. There was only one period in which this peculiar financial fallacy was suited to the needs of the country, and that was in the days of the frontier. The system created bankruptcy and poverty, and the victims moved west and developed the country. It is customary to speak of population pressure as causing the movement west, but that is true only in a limited sense. The East was never too crowded in the pioneer days to support its population insofar as land and raw materials were concerned, but it already had a financial system which automatically created a spread between purchasing power and production, and thereby automatically created an unemployed class which moved west with the next wagon train to rehabilitate itself in a simpler economy. Oh yes, we had an unemployed class in Andrew Jackson's day, but we called them pioneers. So much for the simple fact that in your 1939 economic system, overproduction or underconsumption or a shortage of purchasing power was a chronic condition. Now let us examine the mathematical nature of purchasing power to discover why this was so. In so doing, we shall discover the possible solutions and select the one we like. You see, I've done this problem before and can show off how clever I am. You know about little Jack Horner? I've always suspected that he knew where the plum was before he stuck in his thumb. A grin split Davis's saturnine visage and made him look like a little bald-headed gnome. Consider, if you please, two typical units of production, a factory and a farm. Let the factory be large, an employer with many employees. Let the farm be small, a one-family affair. These two cases will be typical, insofar as price and purchasing power are concerned, of the entire economic organism. First, the factory. It makes, let us say, shoes. These shoes are placed on the market at a definite price. This price consists of two parts, the cost to the owner of the factory of making the shoes plus a profit. The cost consists of a number of items, of which the principal are wages to employees, cost of raw materials, depreciation on capital goods, rent of land, interest on invested capital, and taxes. The additional portion of the price is the profit. This is the return to the owner or entrepreneur for his time, personal labor, ingenuity, and so forth, and is the source from which he must support himself and his family. To assume that profit is unnecessary is to assume that employers don't eat. It was popular in your day to attack the profit system. We shall see that profits to an entrepreneur are not the cause of unemployment and financial distress. Of course, there will arise the question of some entrepreneurs receiving a disproportionate amount of production as their profits, but that is a question of morals, to be regulated according to the current customs. It does not in itself cause unemployment, as we shall see. As a matter of fact, most persons who undertake the enterprise of new production or entrepreneurs did not make an excessive profit. Most of them made no profit and went bankrupt. That is a simple matter of record. In your day, 18 out of 19 businessmen failed in the long run. The groups who attacked the profit system were beating a dead dog. Nevertheless, since entrepreneurs must eat, profits are a legitimate part of the cost of production. Henceforth, we shall include them as cost charges and consider that the necessary value of an article of production is its total cost, or cost to the entrepreneur plus his necessary profit. Perry interrupted. Do you mean to say that the profit system in my day was okay? It seems to me that the profit system was always being attacked as the villain in the piece. The profit system was not the villain in the piece. The villain was ignorance of the workings of the economic mechanism, in which the entrepreneurs or industrial leaders were the greatest offenders. At the very least, the laborers knew that something was wrong and demanded a change, but the industrial entrepreneurs denied that any change was needed and stubbornly resisted change with the ignorant willfulness of a Marie Antoinette. Furthermore, they possessed the economic and political power to resist change. In that way, they were the villains and were responsible for all the tragedy of your era. But let's not condemn them too heartily, as they were ignorant and stupid rather than innately vicious. But now let's prove the statements I have made. Let's put the factory into operation and see how a cycle of production and consumption works. I mentioned a shoe factory. That will give us too limited a case to understand the whole industrial system. You understand the mathematical principle of the general case, the one in which all possible factors appear. Consequently, any individual problem can be solved if you can solve the general case. Of course you do. Very well, then. Let this factory be the general case of any production unit in the country which employs labor and uses capital. Its raw materials will be the materials it processes, even though those materials have previously been processed after leaving Mother Earth. Thus, steel plate or tanned leather may be termed raw material for automobiles factories and luggage factories. The term factory includes buildings and chattels of every sort used in production, but which are not themselves the goods produced by the factory. Land includes the sites of buildings, rights of way, and so forth. Do you follow me? Perry nodded. Sure, it's like any algebraic general case, like the general quadratic equation, for instance. AX squared plus BX plus C equals zero gives a general solution of x equals negative b plus or minus the quantity the square root of b squared minus 4ac all divided by 2a. Substituting the conditions of a particular case gives the answer for that particular case. Note, the full solution of this general problem of the second degree can be found in any textbook of primary algebra. The author. End of note. Exactly. Let's set up the general case of a production-consumption cycle under the rules of your period and work out a few problems. Then perhaps we shall see the principles involved and be able to state a general solution which will answer all our questions about economics. Perry scratched his head. Look, that's all very well in simple algebra like quadratic equations, but in economics we deal with an indefinite number of unknowns and too many factors. How can we possibly do this? We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. All special cases in the actual world are complex, it is true, even in quadratic equations. But the general case may turn out to have pleasing simplicity. Let's try to formulate it and see. Have you pen and paper? Let's write down our elements. What are they? Perry thought. A factory?
Yes.
The entrepreneur or industrialist?
Go ahead.
Raw materials and labor and land.
Continue.
Consumers.
That is right, but who are they?
Everybody, all of the public. Davis nodded. True, but this is the general case. What does that imply? Perry looked puzzled.
I'll tell you then. The consumers are the people you mentioned plus their dependents and no others. Even retired people enter the picture as capitalists or dependents as well as consumers.
Yes, I think I see that. Each individual has a dual role, appearing both on the production side and on the consumption side. Even a child appears as a producer through his father and appears as a consumer of goods purchased by his parents. We can disregard dependents from here on as they are represented economically by the head of the family.
How does a widow living on insurance appear in the setup?
As a consumer of earlier production of the deceased head of a family.
We'll take that case up later when we are ready to deal with it. Let's get on with our setup. What else do we need?
A bank or banks.
Yes, and bankers, stockholders, bank clerks, and so forth. Will you let me lump them together as a bank and a banker, remembering, of course, the collective nature of the terms?
Okay, I guess.
Very well, then. Do we need anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Was the United States an anarchy?
No, of course not.
Then we have the government and all of the subdivisions of government, public servants, taxes and laws, and the government as a consumer.
This grows complicated.
Not too complicated. Let's represent government and all subdivisions as U.S., which you can think of as United States or as us, for in the United States, the government is everybody taken collectively. Public servants work for U.S. Now, do we have all elements?
How about farmers and professional men? They are certainly consumers.
Yes, that's true. The case of the farmer is simple. Economically speaking, he produces in the same fashion as the factory owner, using the same elements, labor, raw material, land, enterprise, and so forth. If he employs no labor but himself and his family, profit should appear as a large item in cost and labor wages as zero. It becomes simply a special case under the general case. The professional man appears as a different type of laborer when he is hired by a production unit, for example, corporation lawyers. Professional men serving the consuming public directly appear in the production-consumption chain in a one-to-one relationship of transfer without destruction of purchasing power. When you pay a medical man $10 for advice, your potential power to purchase and consume donuts or automobiles is reduced $10, and that of the doctor is increased by $10. There is another element we have not named, however. Can you guess it?
No, I'm afraid not. It seems to me we've covered the...
Wait a moment. Technique. Knowledge.
Exactly. Most knowledge is free to all of us, but some things are patented or copyrighted. Let's call the owners of techniques inventors. Now, we are ready to roll.
If we set up our hypothetical domestic economy so that it is structurally similar in every way to the economy of your period, it should work like your period. If we change the man-made laws to those of this present period, it will work like this present period. The natural laws involved remain the same structurally. If we can distinguish between man-made rules and natural necessity, we will know what we can and what we can't do with an economic system.
How can we make any such complicated setup in our heads and be sure that it will work out in practice, Master Davis?
I shan't ask you to carry all of the moving elements of a complicated function in your head. Let's make a model. I see a set of chessmen over there. May I use them? They will do nicely for people. Now, have you anything I can use for counters?
Perry rummaged around and produced a box of poker chips.
Gaming chips? That's fine. Now, we need something to represent the goods we are to produce and consume. What do you suggest? I'll need a number of units, 100 or more.
How about a box of crackers? Suggested Perry.
A happy thought, distinctly consumption goods, but we would get crumbs all over the table, and they are rather bulky. Do you have any playing cards?
Surely. Perry arose and returned with them. Here are a couple of packs.
Very well. Let each card represent one unit of production of equal value. They represent all sorts of items, clothing, food, air cars, games, stereo records, books, and so forth. For convenience, we split them up into equal-valued units. Now, take the chessmen and give them their functions. The Black King is our entrepreneur, industrialist, or farmer.
Davis wrote this on a slip of paper and tucked it under the base of the Black King. There. We will know him when we see him. You will notice that his tag reads Entrepreneur-Consumer to remind us of his dual function. The Black Queen is his wife. Place her with him. Put a pawn with them as their children. Now, another pawn for her father, who is dependent on them. He's a crusty old gentleman who hasn't worked since McKinley was shot and thinks the country is going to hell. The White King is the banker. We'll write a tag for him, Banker Consumer. This box you keep the chessmen in will do as a bank, and this book can be a factory. Put tags on them, but don't place the factory on the table yet. It has not yet been built. The Black Bishop owns the land on which the factory is to rest. He must first be satisfied. The White Castle owns a process to be used in our manufacture of playing cards. Now, take 5 or 6 pawns and mark them laborers' consumers. Mark the black horses, owners of raw materials consumers. Take the white bishops and mark them government employees consumers. Take a separate tag and mark it U.S., but don't place a chessman on it, as we must not personify the government. U.S. is all of us, acting collectively. Note, the reader is urged to make this setup and play it through as he reads. Otherwise, the value of the demonstration will be lost. If chessmen are not available, bottles of ink, spools, tin soldiers, and so forth will serve. Beans, dominoes, or marbles will serve as counters. The author. End of note. Now, we are ready to run through a typical economic cycle. Call it one eon in length, and let it be the time from the building of the factory until it is depreciated in value to zero and is obsolete. Something around 20 years, if you must think in definite terms, but it isn't necessary to do so. Suppose you identify yourself with the entrepreneur, Perry, and I'll play the other pieces. You see a demand for playing cards and determine to manufacture them. You have your eye on a suitable site which you can lease at a reasonable price, and you know of a new process that you can buy up. But you haven't the working capital, all of your wealth being tied up in tangible property which you don't want to liquidate. So, you go to the banker and ask for a loan of 100 shekels. You explain your idea and offer security worth quite a bit more than 100 shekels. From where we sit, we see that the bank contains only 20 shekels, the capital reserve required by law. One might think that the banker would say, "Sorry, old man, you've got a sound proposition, and I'd like to accommodate you, but there isn't that much money in the bank." But he says nothing of the sort. He lends you the money. How does he do it? You give him a promissory note saying, "Dear banker, I owe you 100 shekels at 10% per eon, signed Entrepreneur." He enters that on the books as a bank asset, credits your account with 100 shekels, gives you a bank book and some blank checks, and you thank him for the money, which is new money, monetized by your security and existing only as bookkeeping entries. To symbolize this, I hand you these 100 chips, which you must think of as bank credit or checkbook money, not as greenbacks nor metal coin. But you may use them as money in every respect, for the banker will cash a few of them from time to time out of the small stock of cash he keeps on hand. He can afford to do this because only on rare occasions will all holders of bank credit ask for cash all at once, placing a run on the bank. Usually cash money paid out by the bank comes back the next day and is redeposited. You have your 100 shekels now and can commence operations. You lease a site for 4 shekels for the eon, put 4 chips by the Black Bishop. You build your factory, 8 shekels for raw materials, 8 shekels for labor. Pay out your chips. Now, pay the inventor 4 shekels for the use of his process. Your wages for labor during the eon amount to 44 shekels. Pay it out. And for raw materials, 30 shekels. You will have taxes of 10 shekels during the eon. I can't pay them. I've only 2 chips left. Never mind. You'll be selling some playing cards soon and can pay them as you go along. You now manufacture during the eon 63 playing cards. Stack them there by the factory. You need 8 shekels profit in the course of the eon to support yourself and your family. You figure out what your market price must be for playing cards in order to accomplish this. What would it be? Perry set down his expenses and added them up as follows. Land rent, 4 shekels. Factory labor, 8 shekels. Factory material, 8 shekels. Production labor, 44 shekels. Production material, 30 shekels. Royalty to inventor, 4 shekels. Taxes, 10 shekels. Profit, 8 shekels. Interest on loan, 10 shekels. 126 shekels to be recovered as price. 63 produced units to be sold, therefore price must be 2 shekels each. Perry looked up. I get 2 shekels per card. Correct. As you can see, I arranged the figures to give round numbers. But I can't possibly sell 63 cards at that price. There are only 98 shekels out there to buy my product. Don't be in a hurry. Start selling and see what happens. We will assume this time that all these people that received money from you need all the consumption goods they can afford. Sell to them. Perry dealt out cards to labor, landowner, inventor, and owners of raw materials, and collected 2 chips for each card. How many cards do you have left? 14. You have a lot of money on hand. Better pay your taxes. Okay. Perry placed 10 chips on U.S. Now, I'll act for Uncle Sam and pay the public servants 4 shekels, buy raw materials for 4 shekels, and use 2 shekels to buy consumption goods from you. Here you are. Perry handed Davis a playing card, who placed it on U.S., and gave Perry the remaining 2 chips. Now sell goods to public servants and owners of raw materials. Perry did so, handing out 4 cards and receiving back 8 shekels. Now pay the interest on your loan. You'll be doing so in the course of the time period. Okay, here's 10 shekels. Davis placed them in the bank. The banker with his family, clerks, and so forth needs some consumption goods. Here are 2 shekels. Perry solemnly received them and proffered 1 card to Davis. Now, pay yourself your profit of 8 shekels. Turn it over to your wife. She handles the money in your household. She takes it and spends it for consumption goods. Perry took 8 shekels, placed it by the Black Queen, then picked it up again and placed it by the Black King, and placed 4 cards under the Black Queen. Davis added a comment. That operation is symbolic of thousands of wives of entrepreneurs spending their husbands' incomes on all manners of goods produced in thousands of factories. The eon is over. The cycle is finished. Your factory has depreciated to no value at all. I must remind you that your note is due at the bank. Wait a minute. Why do you assume that the factory is now worthless? It isn't necessary. Had you figured for a shorter period, the cost item labeled factory would have been just the percentage of depreciation during the shorter period. There would have been a smaller number of articles manufactured, smaller items in all respects. The final cost per unit would have been the same, but we decided to run through a full cycle, from the beginning to the end of a producing unit. But come, come, you are stalling for time. What about my note? You owe me 100 shekels. Perry counted up his chips and grinned at him. You'll have to whistle for it. I have only 92 shekels. I have 4 playing cards you can have for the balance. I've no use for playing cards. I'm a banker and I have your promise to pay. Perry shrugged his shoulders and did not reply. Davis continued. Very well, let's get on with the next stage of the game. You have 4 units of overproduction and can't quite pay your note at the bank. But your banker respects your ability. Your original security is still good, and the banker says that conditions are essentially sound. He refinances you to go into production again. You sign a new note, this time for 108 shekels, and now have 100 shekels to your account, but your banker cautions you not to be guilty of overproduction. You go away, feeling somewhat confused, as you don't see where you made your mistake, but the banker must be right, for you certainly were left with 4 playing cards that you could not sell. You decide that the market only requires 59 cards instead of the 63 you produced. So, you do it all over again, producing only 55 cards, which with your carryover of 4 gives you 59 to sell. What is the result? Why, I come out even, I suppose. Do you? Last time you spent 44 shekels on wages and 30 shekels on materials to build 63 playing cards. How much do you spend this time? Let me see, 44 and 30 is 74. The labor and materials cost per unit is 1/63 of that. Perry set it up on his slide rule. It comes to 1.1175 shekels per card. I'm producing 55 cards this time. 55 times 1.175 is 64 and 7/10 shekels. Those people bought 37 cards with their 74 shekels last time. What can they buy this time?
32 and a fraction.
Exactly. You sell your best market 5 fewer cards than last time. As a result of doing the only reasonable thing, you have more cards left over than before. You've thrown some people out of work, you have created less real wealth for the community to use, and you are even farther from being able to pay off your note at the bank, for you now owe 108 shekels and have only 91 with which to pay.
91? I figured 92.
No, 91. Perhaps you forgot that your interest is 11 shekels on 108?
That's right. I figured 10 like last time. Now what happens? It looks like I'm going broke.
Wait a bit. Do you see what caused the original overproduction?
Why, yes, the banker got money out of me that he didn't turn around and spend with me. Everybody else spent their money as it came in.
Then what's the trouble?
Well, it looks to me as if it was the interest you expected me to pay. If I hadn't had to pay you that interest, I'd have come out even.
Not so fast. They weren't exactly equal and could not therefore have been the same thing. Even bankers have to eat. Why should he run a bank if he isn't paid to do it? Tell me, what would the effect have been if anyone else had saved part of his income instead of spending it?
Oh, Perry slapped his thigh. I see. If anyone saves income that he receives from the cycle, it is thrown out of balance and overproduction results.
Exactly. In the problem that we have just gone through, I cast the banker as the thrifty villain simply because banks were the worst offenders. They charged as much interest as they could get and spent very little on consumption, whereas the workers, by and large, had to spend all they got as they went along. But all were guilty of the economic crime of not spending all their purchasing power and thereby saving themselves into bankruptcy. Even a father with his life insurance policy and baby with his penny bank.
Wait a minute, Master Davis. It seems to me that money saved eventually finds its way back into purchasing. Even after several years, it all balances out in time. There should have been some consumers spending their savings in that first cycle to make up for those who managed to save.
There were, of course. If savings are actually tucked away in a sock, it doesn't do much harm. It balances out with just a small carryover of inventories. But most money is not saved that way. Ordinary people invest in life insurance and savings accounts. Industrialists and financiers put it into capital expansion, use it to increase production. In each case, it goes into new production.
But how can that be harmful? We have just shown that money used for production creates new purchasing power to buy the goods produced.
That's true, but you are looking at just one part of the picture. Listen to me carefully. This is the crucial point. Potential purchasing power not spent for consumption, but saved and invested for production in a later cycle, has appeared as cost in both cycles. When it reappears as purchasing power in the second cycle, it is needed there, and still leaves the first cycle out of balance. For example, if money saved out of your playing card cycle were saved to finance a jelly bean production cycle, every shekel of it would appear as cost in the jelly beans and would be needed to purchase jelly beans. It's not available to buy playing cards. To make this exposition rigorous, I should mention the possibility that capital funds are occasionally spent on consumption and that money is sometimes taken out of production entirely. But this also produces unemployment and its attendant evils. The panic of 1907 was of this nature, artificially created by the Morgan Bank and associated interests. But let's get back to your playing card factory. It is in trouble. These cycles continue. Each time the bank owns a bigger piece of your business, and more of your employees are out of work. Eventually, they are in dire distress, and private charity cannot carry the load. Congress provides relief. At first, Congress tries to pay for relief with new taxes, but you businessmen howl that you are losing money now, which is true. Taxes on everybody, such as the sales tax, rob Peter to pay Paul, and increases purchasing power not a whit. It helps a little to tax the higher bracket incomes, but in the long run, that inhibits production by striking at a source of capital expansion. Congress is forced to look elsewhere for money to subsidize purchasing power and provide relief, for the spread between production and purchasing power has grown enormous, more than 30% in your day, billions of dollars a year. Some congressman from the Middle West, who cut his teeth on the Bryan campaigns, proposes that the government print greenbacks to provide relief for the unemployed, but the bankers condemn this as unsound, inflationary, radical, striking at the roots of our institution. They have great political power and carry their point. There is but one thing left to do, and the government does it. It borrows for relief from the banks. True, the banks have very little cash money, but the same law that permitted them to lend you money out of the inkwell enables them to lend to the government with the whole United States as security, the security being represented by interest-bearing tax-free bonds. The national debt climbs sky high, but the system is held together a few more years until the banks own practically everything, even the government. Perry ran his hand through his hair and whistled. You paint a pretty bleak picture. What is the answer? We undertook to set up a general problem, which when solved would answer the question in all cases of how much money does a country need. We set up the general production consumption cycle and worked through some problems under the conditions of your period. We should now be able to work the problem in general terms to arrive at the general answer. I believe you could do it with a little thought, but I will state the general answer for you to inspect and approve or reject. Here it is. A production cycle creates exactly enough purchasing power for its consumption cycle. If any part of this potential purchasing is not used for consumption, but instead is invested in new production, it appears as a cost charge in the new items of production before it reappears as new purchasing power. Therefore, it causes a net loss of purchasing power in the earlier cycle. Therefore, an equal amount of new money is required by the country. This money must be a new issue, not borrowed from the banks, for there is no way to pay it back. To tax it back from the country as a whole is to destroy necessary purchasing power at a later date. To tax it back from the bondholders is a polite name for cancellation, but that was necessary and was eventually done in a roundabout manner. How? By paying off the bonds with new money, then getting it back with inheritance and income taxes. There are several interesting corollaries to our main proposition. Here is one. No economic system can create its own new capital. That must be done by the fiat of the sovereign state. The banks can't do it, even when they are permitted to create money, as they must recover the money they create and loan, plus a charge for the service or interest. Furthermore, banks should not be permitted to create money at all, because they are of necessity interested only in making a profit. They will inflate or deflate the currency to make a profit, regardless of the monetary needs of the country. Their interest rates are a reflection of an artificially created money market with no relation to the cost of the service. No, banks must be required to loan only deposits placed with them for that purpose. That is to say, their reserves must be 100%, not 10% as in your day. They must keep entirely separate the funds left with them for commercial exchange, that is, commercial checking accounts, funds placed with them to invest or loan, and funds deposited for safekeeping. In such a case, the customer pays for the service of checking and exchange, pays for the service of safekeeping, and receives interest on funds deposited for investment. But the banker no longer manipulates the money supply of the nation to suit his convenience. Furthermore, from what we define money to be, and from our examination of the production-consumption cycle, we reach the important conclusion that there is no necessary one-to-one relationship between taxes and government expenditure. If a country is expanding industrially, as the United States has since it was founded, the government is obliged to put out more money than it receives in amount equal to new capital investment in order to avoid deflation. This is new money never received in taxes. In fact, the federal government need not tax at all except as a regulatory measure. It needs no taxes for revenue. It must never tax as much as it spends or gives away as long as production is rising. This gives the government remarkable freedom. If a new battleship or a new highway was needed in your day, the economically sound thing to do would have been to go ahead and build, paying for it with new currency. Congress should consider only two things. Does the country need this battleship or road? And is the country rich enough in manpower and materials to produce it? If both answers are yes, go ahead and issue new money to do it. Just a moment, Master Davis. What is this new money worth, if anything? How do you mean that? Well, in my day, money could be exchanged for gold, not very easily, but it could be done. How can one be sure that this new money is anything but pieces of paper? As I told you before, the government will accept it for taxes and for services such as the postal service, but you want to know what it is worth in terms of real wealth, just as the old-style dollar was worth so many grains of gold. Very well. If you present a draft for 1,000 credit units or dollar bills to any one of several government warehouses, the bursar will give you an assorted group of basic commodities of weights and standards specified by law.
Where does the government get these commodities?
Grows or makes them, buys them in the open market, and may occasionally accept some of them as taxes.
That seems awfully cumbersome compared with the gold standard.
It is cumbersome, but it's worthwhile, for it gives a much more nearly stable medium of exchange than gold. As a matter of practice, the government keeps very small stocks of commodities because with a stable standard for money, the public prefers cash or credit at the Bank of the United States to the trouble of handling bulk in commodities. They are satisfied to know that they can get real wealth in specified amounts if they choose.
How about foreign trade? This sort of money would be a nuisance there.